This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. Mark McMorris is here. He's one of the most startling poets that I have ever found. And his new book has just been published this year. And Mark is going to let you hear his voice with a poem from this new book.
This poem is called Lines on the Desert, and I'm going to read the first part. In its rising, the wind blows me towards you. Where you are in the lattices, graph paper visible over the rocks. Where I am in light mixed with powder. The blue is depthless solid. The land goes around the mountain and continues out of sight. Where I am is not an exact place. Field theory says that a thing has a pattern and a probable landing. You look for me in the particles of noise streaming through the rectangle. Under that mountain is a giant asleep since the last thunderstorm. The clouds are his horses, abandoned to latitudes the airplane divides and conquers. Not where a flamingo stands in marsh grass, billowing white forms and the fuselage.
The voice of Mark McMorris, and he has written a book entitled The Book of Landings, which is really two volumes in one, and it is the last of a three-part trilogy. He's twice won the Contemporary Poetry Series Prize, and he's the recipient of the Gertrude Stein Award in Innovative American Poetry. What do you think the word innovative means regarding you and your work?
That is a very good question, and it is one that my friends and I, we've been touching on and coming back to and circling around and embracing and rejecting and quarreling with for as long as I have been, I guess, involved in poetry and poetry communities. It's a word that I suppose is meant to signal a difference of some kind, maybe even to signal an interest in a particular tradition of American poetry that is connected to, I guess one would say, something like William Carlos Williams, more so than it is connected to somebody like, say, Robert Lowell.
So you're building a poem, you're constructing a poem, and you relate it to art, you relate it to geometry, you relate it to many alternative theories. But I like to hear your voice, so continue the rest of the poem you were reading to us, and we'll continue this conversation.
The desert is a place without music. When you enter it, you enter a noiseless, transparent stadium of brown-green and ochre stubble, minimally raised into the wall of ridges isolated under the clouds. To cross the plateau takes a day of willful blindness. You have to want what it has to set out close to sunrise, to leave behind the car park's tarmac and railcar platform and boxcars, and follow the writing of the terrain to stand to touch a geological event. People who live under an open sky, ceiling of auditorium, deep blue and lilac hills at sundown, and the dove clouds sprawling and changing volumes by dictate of accidental and vacuous whispers of desert winds calling to copy forms marked down in folios no scribe has inked, no illuminators. What can they know of the uncharitable sea? The desert plain fosters geometrical designs uncommonly okay with transience. The surface becomes 12, becomes one, with estuaries like open jaws.
Those are beautiful words, Mark. If I were to say that this book is about nomads, colonization, migration, war, slavery, Barcelona, Miro, Michael, and using words as equipment, would you say I was right about this book?
I would have to agree that all of that is part of, I guess, the fabric of you know, what I think I'm working with. Yeah, absolutely. There's a way that, you know, that I think I want to bring things together that perhaps, you know, one might not find together in other kinds of writing.
That's true.
In certain kinds of prose or other genres. You know, and the great thing about poetry is that I think because it is so flexible, it allows you to construct the present tense out of a kind of a disparate variety of materials from the past and from multiple geographies.
Fragments are very important to you, and this book is made of fragments, and we'll talk about that further. I want them to know who you are. Mark has several degrees from Brown University.
That's right.
Okay. An MA in creative writing?
Yes.
That was poetry. An MA in Greek and Latin studies? No? Tell me why.
Oh, I spent time in the classics department at Brown, and then I transferred over to comparative literature. So that my MA, in addition to the one I have in creative writing, is actually in comparative literature, with my languages being Greek and Latin. The degree is not actually in classics. The degree is in comparative
literature.
But
you're a classicist.
I have been called a classicist.
I'm calling you one.
I'm not sure that I would entirely embrace that term, having been among classicists.
You also have a PhD in comparative literature. And let's hear another poem.
This poem is called Birds as More Than Metaphor. I guess it's a kind of poet's poem. Crusoe's was a land without metaphor. This saith the poet, and we listen to cicadas stirring in the rosebush and think that the voice of the earth, the waves rasping and billowing to crash the seawall, and the noisy seagulls angling like foghorns in their flight about the lighthouse or on a rock, that these instances of theater demand translation, not an auditor content with solitude and a parasol, his palisade staked to ward off 1,000 cannibals. Certainly, it is not enough to cherish the oleander's dignity, but it is to speak why we came and copied the mallard's hieroglyph, traced the heron's flight above the mangroves, and hewed a symbol common to the egret and our melancholy. And is it not then more than we can say bird and mean what it is, the osprey nesting on a post beside the reservoir, ornis barajo avis oianos, and mean more than a tropical species, more than a silhouette, like a profile blends with a girl who poses, undressed on a veranda open to the salt breeze, that her figure coincides with the voice. The myths have departed into mythology, and what is the form of desire to weld the rain to our nerves, unless it be the form displayed on sand, on the wind's writing, over the staggering mountains, where we hid and formed a metaphor to be our living.
The voice of Mark McMorris. I'm Grace Cavalieri, and we're at the Library of Congress celebrating this new book, The Book of Landings. You know, Mark, I know your purpose in life is to take language and to turn it around and break it open and create new forms and see what can happen. But in spite of yourself, you are very lyrical. I know that this is going to surprise you, but you can't help it. That lyricism and cadence and phraseology in that last poem is truly among the traditional poems. Now, that's one of a few, because I know that's not your purpose in life. But I would like to ask you this. Why does it matter that we take words and rinse them off and turn them on edge and make them new? What does it mean to culture?
I'm not going to complain that you have identified a lyrical impulse in this book and in my writing generally, because I am completely and 100% a partisan of the lyric and of lyricism and of lyric energy and of the lyric in lyric historically. Mm-hmm. This is something that you know, I cherish greatly. And in fact, I might even go so far, and this is a kind of a stubbornness in me, to identify poetry with lyric.
That surprises me. I would like to hear another poem, because we're getting to know you through your poetry. So for the next poem, just set it up. Tell us what part of the book it is from.
Yes. Okay. So I'm going to read a poem connected to Barcelona. The second volume of the Book of Landings, the City of Palimpsests, contains a section devoted to Barcelona and another section devoted to Marrakesh.
Would you tell the audience what palimpsest means?
Palimpsest. Okay, so a palimpsest refers to a writing surface that has been scraped clean, a writing surface that has been written on and then scraped clean of its writing so that it can then serve a second time or a third time or a fifth time as a writing surface.
Layers. Yes. So read us a poem.
Absolutely. I'm going to skip to the Barcelona series poem that's called, you mentioned lyric, and which suggests an interest in, I guess, forms or genres. And this poem from the Barcelona series is called Baroque Modernism.
What is it with you in Barcelona?
What is it with me in Barcelona? I mean, aside from the fact that I lived in Barcelona for a year not too long ago and loved the city and became familiar with, you know, the ins and outs of the alleyways and some of the ins and outs of the history.
And the history
and the culture
is here, yeah.
And, you know, they're kind of like their version of cultural nationalism or cultural autonomy.
There's a lot of history about the war there, and much in your book to learn.
Well, Miró had always been a favorite of mine.
Would tell everyone who Miró is.
Miró, Joan Miró, who is, I guess, the preeminent painter of Catalonia, who flourished from, let's say, the period of Surrealism right down into the 1970s. Mm-hmm. There is a museum called the Fundación Miró devoted entirely to his work.
You have some pictures
in Barcelona.
In here, yeah.
And I spent many days and weeks.
Well, your poems reflect that.
In the Miró Museum. Baroque modernism. So there's some influence in Miró's movements, I guess, the way he connects things. The eye is an elementary shape, like a stone, it sits in a canal, cut into a stick that is flat, and because it rests on water, in a bowl, like a compass needle, an eye borrows the light, like white stone carved to the semblance of masked workers and heroes. What if when you looked at a surface, you saw eyes looking? What if you were expecting a tailor's guild hat and heard only the sounds of wire?
That is my taste. I really liked that poem very much in this book. Let's have another poem.
Well, I've been writing a series of poems addressed to a hypothetical interlocutor called Michael.
Yes.
Should I read one of those?
Yes. Who's Michael? I thought, now this Michael is he is an invisible friend. He's a sounding board for your intellectual ideas. And you're just trying them out as if you're writing an epistolary relationship with Michael. So let's hear one.
This is Michael number 25. Dear Michael, if poetry is not bred to fortify the righteous, is it because we miss in it the savor of contest, the whisper of blessing over a martyr's name, the light of sacral plans to take the citadel once and for all or give it up? On the original streets lit by the sun of 19th century novels, the workers are gathering to march for their dignity and bread. The planters did not die of happiness. Other exhibits show their meadows, their horses and women, the English sunset in lands never more than a sigh, like a vowel far from home. We ask too much when of the little that we have. In good health, fondly yours.
And Michael is throughout this book, actually. And so how many poems altogether are to Michael? Is that the 25th and last one?
I may have some more.
Will he always be with you?
I hope so. I hope that I can be Duncan-esque in writing, the serial that extends across many, many books.
In your book, you often use graphics to make a point with your words. You use the geography of the page to make a political point about language. How do you believe that the graphics, the nonverbal, help to ground the verbal?
This goes back to my envy of visual artists, and this idea that I had after the first volume was almost finished, of the fragility of the word, the fragility of writing,
yes,
its tendency to vanish, to become erased, to crumble, to have its meaning drained away from it over time, and this I found very disturbing, and of course being completely incompetent as a visual artist, a drawer of things, a painter of things. I can't draw a box that will look like a box. I thought, the visual artists, when they make their marks, when they take that pencil or that charcoal or that pen and they make their mark and they bite into the surface, there's no question that a hand was there, that a hand pressed and left that impression, and that hand is connected to the person, the name and the person whose hand it is. So there's this physical connection between the person and the surface and the mark left behind. And I thought, I really wish that the words of a poem could have that kind of indelibility, instead of being, evanescent and fragile.
Well said. May I say that the introduction to your book is an essay, which I hope will be one of many essays in a book of essays, because I think you elucidate that point very, very clearly. And it's a difficult one to understand. So I would recommend that everyone who gets this book of poetry read the introduction carefully, too. So let's have another poem. This is Mark McMorris. He was born in Kingston, Jamaica, and he is a professor at Georgetown University. His collections of poetry include Entre Poe, which was in 2010, The Café of Light, The Blaze of the Puy, and that was one of the ones that C.D. Wright awarded the Contemporary Poetry Series Prize. You also were a finalist for the Lenore Marshall Poetry Prize. You've taught at Brown University and the University of California, and you were an associate professor, so you just have made professor.
A few years ago.
A few years ago?
A few years ago.
Ah. Did you know Roland Flint?
I arrived after Roland Flint had departed.
Have taken his place.
I think so. Yeah. I think there was a feeling that he had built something having to do with poetry and an interest in that students had, and so there was a need to continue that.
Thank you for that. And another poem.
Another poem then. Practical Green Table. This is a short one. I thought to write an elegy as a reply to your questions, to pitch the word as far forward, like a dolphin out of the sea, over a threshold, to behold the land as practical and green as this table, a space to write and walk into like a kitchen, hearing the conjunct vowels. What does a reader suppose if not the promise of a text, the ultimate form at the end of a chain of forms, infinite, summed, to a singular value, the elegy as a place to begin.
That's a good thing to lead into my next thought, because your work is very much depicting movement and geography and motion and change of the physical landscape also. Now, it's about voyages. In fact, one of your works is about who is the leader of the ship that was in Roman mythology, Palinurus.
Palinurus was the pilot of was Aeneas's helmsman.
Right, and so you talk about him as a navigator, and navigation is very important in your work. And entrepôt is about place. Okay, now you're trying to depart from place everywhere you go in all of your poems.
Mm-hmm.
It's always about leaving place. You don't want to be in a receptacle, mm-hmm. right? And so why is the book titled The Book of Landings?
Yes, that is an excellent question. I guess in a sense that it's the verbal noun, the ing there, and it's plural. So the plural and the gerund suggest, a repetition or a continuation, if you will. So not landing and then we're there, but multiple landings at different times, perhaps, or landings on different surfaces, landings at different
that
points in the geography.
Sense. Makes perfect
perhaps,
sense.
Perhaps.
Was that hard to come by, that title?
It was excruciating.
Because you just needed the right title for this book. Because it also was a puzzlement to me as I read your work. And it seems like you're always wanting not to be fixed. You just do not believe the word should be fixed, that an idea should be fixed. You want it always in motion. You just want it to implode all the time.
Well, okay. So underlying all of this, though, is this idea of diaspora.
Yes.
That one of the signal conditions of our modernity is the movement of, or as Homi Bhabha said at one point, the scattering of the world's peoples. And I think of this scattering as not as a relocation from point A to point B, where now you're at point B and you stay there. That is, of course, the desire or the hope is to find and to found a new homeland. But I think if we look about us, what we are, what we might discern is that when you get to B, you then find yourself moving on. That B doesn't prove to be the new homeland. It doesn't prove to be the site of utopia, the lost paradise. But that there is a propulsion, forces that cause the repetition of that initial movement. So thinking about those forces at play in our world and diaspora and the scattering of peoples, it seems to me that I might try to with an awareness of that, to write with an awareness of that, if you will. And so maybe that accounts for you're absolutely very perceptive and very articulated, very well articulated sense that this book has an interest in mobilities of various kinds, within language, outside of language.
Yes, it's political in the movement of people, but it is really also spiritually moving, morally moving, and motion is its fuel. Let us have a final poem.
So this is, in fact, the last poem of the book. It's called The Last City. There is always another city. You come to Risani, the people, their tongue, their way of navigating the streets, their gods. You say that this is the limit of cities, beyond which is neither east nor west, but only the curve of earth falling into the valley, pastured by the sun and walked by stars of an abstruse geometry. There is no further to go than this. You are at the frontier where all roads and all rivers sink into the sky like a prayer. Only the exile whispers as he stares deep into a calyx. There is always another city. There is a city called Sigilmassa that was forgotten by the diggers of labyrinths and archangels. City of concubines, harsh city of slaves, gold and spices, city of weeping, city of boulevards and gardens, ibises and fountains, and the wind culling an alphabet from a bird's walk. There is always another city, hidden in your footsteps like a song sung by a harlequin, as the poplars tremble and the wind stirs. There is always another city. Say if I travel past this milepost, the road will become its double. The journey home will lead me to you, woman who bears her soldier to the twilight of cathedrals. The city strikes 12 in her face. There is always another city, another acropolis, another citrus grove, to replace the one you long for. There is always another city, and in her palm you see the zero of an orchid plucked from a guitar. There is always another city hidden in your belt, the city of empty libraries and tambourines, the city you call the last city, the city of iron, the ordeal and quest assigned to those who eat offal, a city where there is no language to name it except the tongue of lizards. There is a city never visited by Herodotus which is stranger than this, not even a book, only the idea of a book, the thought of paradise, and the idea of a reader and a place to set it down.
The voice of Mark McMorris. This program is produced by Forestwood Media Productions. Post-production by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making this program possible. Funding is provided by the Witter Binner Foundation for Poetry, the Reva and David Logan Foundation, and Friend of Poetry, Hiram LaRue. Our engineer is Mike Turpin. I'm Grace Cavalieri.